It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week, we're taking a democratic approach to wine, using junk food to show how to pair wine with food. Take spicy Doritos, for instance.
This opens the door for sweet wines, and people are afraid to like sweet wines, or they think that it's, you know, de classe. I say you have to have sweet to beat the heat.
Okay.
And that's a rule of thumb in all wine pairing, from spicy Doritos straight through to spicy curries, spicy Szechuan, you name it. And probably I'd go red because we're talking about, you know, cheese in quotation marks, right, if the Doritos.
Right.
I would pair it with maybe a nice Lambrusco or even a Brachetto d'Acqui from Piedmont.
That's wine writer Anthony Giglio. And lots more is coming your way, including Marcus Samuelson's Ethnic Pantry, this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. How does an ace chef and philanthropist begin? Well, how about at a hot dog stand in Sweden? That was Marcus Samuelson's first food job. An Ethiopian child, orphaned at three, he was adopted by a Swedish family. Eventually, he came to America, where he became the youngest chef to earn 3 stars from the New York Times. Well, today he has Red Rooster in Harlem, other eateries in the United States, and several in Sweden. Lifestyle and fashion magazines want photo shoots, and he probably works as hard at raising money for charities around the world as at his stove. Well, Marcus's latest book is Marcus Off Duty, The Recipes I Cook at Home. Marcus got together with our contributor, Rebecca Shear.
Hi there, Marcus. Welcome.
I'm so happy that you say welcome. I feel welcome now. Thank you.
So let's talk about the very start of the book. You talk about your grandmother's kitchen.
Yes.
And how that's where your journey with cooking began, and how now you feel you've come full circle, which I love. I love that phrase. Tell us about your early memories of home cooking and how exactly it is that you've managed to come full circle from those early days.
Well, first of all, I would have loved to have had at least a week with my grandmother now, right? Wouldn't we all? But she's not here, but she's looking, sitting above and looking down on us, and she would be laughing because everything she cooked is hip now. If she would have known that fish liver and pig feet and pig ear and carrots would be in the latest kale coming from the latest Brussels sprouts, you know, she would have been like, what's going on? You went to cooking school to cook what I taught you? You know, so that's a statement right there, right? Sometimes we have to go back in order to move forward.
You talked about your family, and you have a wonderful multinational family. Talk about all the different branches and locations.
Yeah, I mean, I thought every family growing up was Swedish, a little bit Korean, a little bit Jewish, and a little bit Ethiopian. But you know what? It's an interesting time to grow up in the 80s in Sweden. And if that's not American 2015, I don't know what is, right? So I feel very fortunate that I was raised in a multicultural family, and it came through food. You know, when we went to the summer house, we ate fish 4 days a week. You know, we woke up at 6. We went out fishing. Maybe we got 30 to 40 mackerels. We cleaned them on the boat. We cooked 10 for lunch. We preserved, we smoked or pickled 10. We give 10 away to our neighbors. And maybe we got a chance to sell 4 or 5 of them ourselves. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
No waste. Fresh farm to table before the term even existed. The garnishes was maybe wild chives that grew, still grows outside of the house, potatoes, and a little bit of yogurt. That was it. But I can't imagine eating fresher, more locally. And we came out of not having money, but we ate well. So being poor, but feeling rich.
And extending that multiculturalism of your family, your cookbook is incredible. It's global. It includes everything from coconut lime curried chicken to lamb lasagna. We have Ethiopian tostadas.
Yes.
So it looks to me like you must have an enormous pantry, and I would love for you to give us some idea of what to do with what might seem like some of the more exotic ingredients you include. I'm especially intrigued by that Southeast Asian chili paste you mentioned, sambal oelek.
Sambal oelek is wonderful, you know. It's really a chili, almost like a chili paste, a little bit rougher than a chili paste. Sambals are used all over Southeast Asia, also a lot in South Africa, actually. And it's a great rub. It's a great spice enhancer. Very similar to the more popular known sriracha in a taste. It has no sweetener. It's just really delicious. And you can, you know, thin it out with some olive oil, rub it on a chicken. You can add soy and lime juice, and it can be a vinaigrette. So I love flavor, you know, a pantry that very quickly, with a little bit of acid and a little bit of salt, a little bit of oil, you can just go in different places. So, and this is really what America is today, you know. Look at a city like D.C. You have everything in the world here. Think about, when I think about L.A. and San Francisco and so on, and New York, it's just diverse, and it's very American. It's not so much about how authentic it is. It's about how delicious you want to make it. So I always say, expand on your pantry. Buy something you're not familiar with. You know, try it out. Like miso, for example. You know, we all are familiar with miso soup. But, you know, there's blonde miso, there's red miso, there's dark miso. Well, dark miso, I would rub on a steak, on red meat. Blonde miso, I would use for fish and vegetables. Red miso, I would use for poultry or vegetables, roasted vegetables. So these fermented soybeans is something that started as a preserving technique, like most preserving techniques. But they're today flavor enhancer. They're delicious.
What about harissa?
So you're just using all the difficult words there. Harissa is from Morocco and Tunisia, and it's a wonderful spice blend because just like Northern African cuisine, it's flavorful but not overpowered spicy, right? So harissa is wonderful to mix with some Dijon mustard, and you can have like a mustard on a hot dog or a merguez. It's also super delicious with just like, again, roasted root vegetables. Chicken, fish, and lamb. Lamb is super delicious. I would just steam fish, brush it with some mint and harissa. Super delicious. We got to stop just looking at sort of European-American food. We have the whole world, and it's a more better reflection. For me, it's nothing could be more than American than just trying to find the best ingredients and make them ours, right? And that's really what Off Duty is about. That's what the cookbook is about. It's got to be yummy, delicious. You got to learn something when you do, and you got to have fun.
So I think a lot of people flipping through your cookbook, they might look at so many ingredients and dishes as ethnic.
That
word, ethnic.
That word is so, I don't even know what that word means, because everyone is ethnic. Everyone has ethnicity, right? What does that mean? Does that mean that black and brown people and Chinese people are ethnic and white people are not? Every group, you come, whether you're English and German, that's no ethnicity, right? So it's also become this sort of quasi word for explaining that's strange and we have balsamic vinegar, but we don't do sambal oelek. Come on, like Mexican food for me, it's part of an American vocabulary today, right? Is that left ethnic or is that still ethnic? I don't even know when you get the ethnic passport. Is that in Canada or is that in Texas? I'm not cool. I don't really care about it. I just think it's like delicious food you can find all over the world. Sauerkraut is just as delicious as kimchi in the right preparation, right?
Right.
But also, we got to be there's some values that we got to share and say, hey, this is actually better. And then there's some values we got to go back to, right? So we're becoming more diverse, but we're also cooking much more throwback and vintage. We're being more local than ever, right? So we're being both more global in terms of where they come from, but we're also being more local. We care about Farmer Ben and his carrots. We didn't care about Farmer Ben before, whoever, you know, who else. So there's many things happening.
Marcus Samuelson, thanks so much for coming.
Tusen takk. Hej då.
Marcus Samuelson is the author of Marcus Off Duty. Rebecca Shear is the host of Metro Connection on WAMU in Washington, D.C. Now, Marcus left us with a recipe for Durban curry buns, and you can find it at splendidtable.org. How can anyone govern a nation that has 246 different kinds of cheese? That was the heartfelt question from Charles de Gaulle in the 1951 French presidential elections. Nearly every nook in France produces some kind of cheese, but some French connoisseurs feel that what they believe is the only real kind of cheese, those made from raw, unpasteurized milk, is a dying breed. BBC reporter John Lawrenson followed his nose in the Camembert-producing region of Normandy in northern France.
Really nice smell of milk.
After you will have the smell of the cheese, but here
yeah, it smells like a dairy.
In the warm steam of the Fromagerie Gillot, women ladle raw milk into lines of round moulds. They've been making Camembert cheese like this for 100 years. There are only 9 traditional Camembert makers left in Normandy. This is the biggest, 24,000 cheeses a day, which might sound like a lot, but not when you consider that the French consume each day almost 1.5 million Camembert cheeses, 9 out of 10 of them made from pasteurised milk. The reason they don't go for the traditional ones? The price, says Gillot export manager Charlotte Fléchard.
It costs more because it's handmade, so we need more people, we need more analyse.
Yes, you have to go through quite strict controls of the bacteria, and that's quite costly.
Yeah, we have more control because it's raw milk.
Is it dangerous, eating raw milk cheese like Camembert?
Me, I'm eating Camembert since I was born, and I've never had any problems.
These cows eat a lot of green Normandy grass and produce a lot of creamy milk that goes to make cheese that's admired the world over. But that heritage is disappearing.
La galette des Monts d'Or, persillée de tigne, le dauphin.
Véronique Richer-Lerouge, president of the Real Cheese Association, lists some of the cheeses that are now extinct. They include one called Sans Souci, No Worries. She's the author of a book entitled France, Your Cheese is Going Down the Drain.
In 1950, in France, all cheese was raw milk cheese. And now we have 10%. And tomorrow it will be less and less. The first cheese in Auvergne, like Cantal, is 2,000 years. So you imagine what we are losing in 10 years, 20 years. It's really fast to destroy it.
Madame Richer-Lerouge says the supermarkets and big dairy companies are to blame. The former prefer pasteurised milk cheese because it has a longer shelf life, the latter because it's so much cheaper to make.
The smell is very attractive. You want to bite in it, and yeah, the texture.
If that's the case, France's cheese cognoscenti believe French consumers have lost the plot.
There's a sort of a bitterness, but in a good way, a slight sting, together with the grass and the flour taste. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At Tout un Fromage, his shop in Rambouillet, west of Paris, Ludovic Bizot enthuses about an Alpine cheese called Abondance, a raw milk cheese like almost every cheese he sells.
Some pasteurized cheeses are very good, but if you compare the same cheese made with or without raw milk, then there is a difference, and raw milk is better. For a simple reason, that pasteurizing the milk kills a number of living organisms that give the flavor. There's a revival of some ancient cheeses that some local farmers knew about or find documents about, and then they sit together and decide to make it again. Wow. And so we have a few reborn cheeses.
Wow.
Jesus is reborn, like Jesus.
That was reporter John Lawrenson reporting for the BBC. Now, just for the record, the Food and Drug Administration and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention recommend pasteurization for all milk consumed by people in the United States. And as you'd expect, many cheese lovers disagree. Coming up, a tour of Cuba's home kitchens and the best wine match for Cheetos? Well, I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. In putting together a list of great places to eat, Cuba usually does not make that list. But perhaps it should. According to the authors of The Cuban Table, Cuba is a land of private renown. Its culinary prowess is hidden in plain sight, remaining in the family and passed down through old, well-read cookbooks that are rarely seen outside of their communities. American photographer Ellen Silverman and Cuban-American food writer Ana Sofia Peláez documented those private home cooks in their book, The Cuban Table. Ana, Ellen, great to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you, Lynn. It's a pleasure.
Ana, we understand Cuba is suffered from the point of view that there's just very little food. Living is not easy. But give us a taste. What is it like to eat there? What is it like to eat with people there?
I always say the first meal I had in Cuba was our aunt offered us hot chocolate, and she had this farmer's cheese that they had found from people that at that time it was like going through the regular markets, going through where you had the ration cards was very difficult what you can get, but people would go door to door, and what they brought in from the country was usually much better than what you could find in the city. And she had this farmer's cheese, but there were a lot of stones in it. So my first meal in Cuba, I've always had this image of just eating this stony meal. And then we were able to kind of hand off everything that we had brought with us from Miami to Nana, who was someone who took care of my aunt and taking care of my family for many years. And she was able to do a lot with that. And the meals that we had at home were wonderful because Nana could just do, she could make a wonderful meal out of stone. So it was literally, she was masterful at that. So when we had in that home was wonderful. And then when we stepped outside, we realized how different it was and how different the average Cuban was living.
Ellen, you talk about on the first trip that you got out of Havana and it was a very different world. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes. Once we got out of the city and out into the countryside, there was much more abundance in terms of fruits and vegetables. And, of course, being in the countryside, people are more relaxed. And not on this first trip, but on one of my subsequent trips, I was visiting with a family in Vinales up in the countryside, up in a wonderful spot up on a hill with a fabulous view. And the son of the elderly woman who we were visiting cooked lunch for us. And it was one of the most delicious meals, I have to say, that I've ever had. And what was so special about it is that everything had been pulled from the earth that morning. He made us an omelet from his chickens that were running around the yard. We had boiled yuca. He made yuca chips fried in oil that were cut by hand, but I don't know how he cut them so thin. They were just delicious, and he sprinkled them with salt and some vinegar. And we finished with bananas from their tree and freshly brewed coffee from their coffee plants, and all cooked over a wood fire. Humble, but so delicious and gracious.
The restaurants in Cuba, what are they like?
There's two kinds of restaurants in Cuba. There are the state-run restaurants, and then there are the paladares. And the paladares are privately owned restaurants in a way. They're licensed so that people can operate these restaurants, which originally were supposed to be from people's homes, and they even had to be every person who worked in the restaurant had to be a member of your family. And then the state-run restaurants, which the food is very, it's, you know, it could be very, very plain, very, very bland in a way. It was very much in line with whatever could be found and was allowed. Then the paladares, there was inconsistency, but there was also the possibility of pulling something off and having that inspiration and having something that you can do yourself if you can find the ingredients and make that work.
There were also a lot of roadside restaurants.
Yes, we would just pull off the side of the road. We would pick a paladari, one that looked maybe we liked the name of it or it just looked inviting, and we'd stop and
You know, we would have, again, most of the places we went, I have to say the meals I had were absolutely delicious and always finished with flan and a couple of cold beers. You know, we would be eating arroz con pollo or vieja ropa.
Maybe you ought to explain what those dishes are.
I'm going to have Anna explain because she's going to do a better job than I would. I can just tell you they were absolutely delicious.
Anna, what? Now, there are the arroz con pollo is the chicken with rice and the, is it ropa vieja? Meaning it's a beef stew, isn't it?
It's a beef stew. You basically cook a flank steak or you know, brisket for a very long time until it's just falling apart. And you prepare sofrito, which sofrito is always the base of garlic, onion, and pepper. And then sometimes there's, you know, some variations to that. And you cook that all together in a tomato sauce.
Ah.
And it's all just like, you know, just it's like it's called, it translates to old clothes. And it's just this like, it just becomes very sweet and tender. And it's just, you know, food that's beef that's just been cooked to the point where it's just like falling apart. And it's wonderful. It's one of the first dishes that I remember growing up going into my grandmother's kitchen and like looking up at this giant stove and her asking her like, well, what are we having today? And she said, ropa vieja. And I thought, oh God, she's done it. I really thought that I could peer into that pot and it was just going to be all this old clothes
rags
that she was just cooking and going. And it wasn't. It was a nice surprise. And I ate it, but I ate it thinking that it was old clothes, that it was just old clothes that tasted really, really great and that I enjoyed.
Well, now those are both dishes that are you constantly hear about. Did you run into anything in Cuba that was totally unexpected?
I don't think I ran into anything that was unexpected or that I hadn't heard of before. There were some things that I had heard of that I hadn't seen yet, which was great. Something that they'd always told me about growing up was cooking the pork chunks in their own fat. And it's almost like a confit style technique of cooking. And that it would be kept there for weeks and months. And once you'd cooked it, they would just leave it out there in this fat and just use it as they needed to. So I hadn't seen that until we left Cuba and we saw this in Artemisa in a farmhouse. And it was exactly that. It was just this bubbling cauldron of fat that they would make this pork in. And it was the most wonderful, you know, fried pork that I'd had. So that was wonderful to see because when they describe it, there wasn't anything appetizing about it.
Right.
But then when it makes perfect sense that it's confit style, it's a very, you know, it's a lot of other countries apply this technique and it's wonderful.
Yeah, the French do it with goose and duck. Ellen, Anna, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Ellen Silverman and Anna Sophia Pelaez are the authors of The Cuban Table. Now, they left us with a recipe for a classic Cuban dish, arroz con pollo. Find it at, well, you know where, splendidtable.org. When we think of wine pairings, we tend to think fancy schmancy. Duck seared and lacquered with port and wild cherries. Mustard-crusted Bronzino. Chateaubriand. But what about pizza, Doritos, or a Taco Bell gordita? Just because food isn't oat doesn't mean it isn't worthy of a good wine. At least that's the philosophy of wine writer Anthony Giglio. Our contributor David Leet tries, in vain, to stump the master.
Anthony, welcome to the show. It's great to see you.
David, I'm thrilled to be here.
So let's talk about this whole idea of wine pairing and junk food. How did you ever end up there?
It takes an editor.
And, okay.
His name is James Curry, and he is my editor at Details Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
He threw this at me and said, what about junk food? Let's talk about junk food. I know you've done this in the past, and it's true. I've done it at a few seminars, and it was just a lot of fun.
And has there ever been a junk food that you've not been able to pair?
I think pickles are probably one of the most challenging things because of all that vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
But I, if there's a will, there's a way, David.
Okay. All right. So as the wine guy, I've got a couple of foods that I will admit that I have indulged in at least once or twice or 10 times. And I want to know what you think would be great wines to pair with them. So spicy Doritos, not the regular, the spicy ones.
The spicy ones. This is great because this opens the door for sweet wines. And people are afraid to like sweet wines or they think that it's, you know, de classe. I say you have to have sweet to beat the heat.
Okay.
And that's a rule of thumb in all wine pairing from spicy Doritos straight through to spicy curries, spicy Szechuan, you name it. And I would pair that. Probably I'd go red because we're talking about, you know, cheese in quotation marks, right? If they're Doritos, I would pair it with maybe a nice Lambrusco or even a Bracchetto d'Acqui from Piedmont.
Okay, excellent. Somewhat similar, Cheetos, not the crunchy kind, but the soft kind.
So the soft kind, we're not talking heat anymore. We're just talking, again, quote unquote, cheese.
Right.
I'd probably go white with this, maybe some nice bracing acidity from a nice Sauvignon Blanc like a Sancerre,
mm-hmm.
or a twist-off Sauvignon Blanc from California. I'm fine with any of it.
Okay. All right. This was one of my favorite things as a kid. Not that I was drinking wine as a kid, but McDonald's Filet-O-Fish. You get all those flavors with the cheese. You have the tartar sauce, which is a little bit, you know, pickly, and you have the fish in the bun.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but there are levels of complexity to be addressed here. But
yes, there are.
When I think of the Filet-O-Fish, I have this, you know, this wave of Lenten want comes over me, and I think of my childhood where my grandmother lived upstairs and cooked us those dreadful fried fish dinners for Lent.
I have those too.
All my people are from Campania, so I'm going to go with a floral, beautiful, aromatic white from Campania, like Fiano d'Avellino or a Falanghina.
Okay.
How about that?
That works. That works. Moving now to Mexico. Taco Bell Gordita.
I have never had this in my life, but I have a friend who loves them, and I asked what this means. And
what it means.
I'm going to go with the cheesy Gordita Crunch.
Okay, yeah.
I want to pair it to that. So again, we have spicy heat. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, one of the best foils for heat is beer. And so if we're having Mexican, why not get a beautiful like Negro Modelo and
Mexican
with lime? Mm-hmm. And that's going to plow right through the heat. And it's a great pairing, actually.
Okay. And then the last one, this is something that we have eaten. I do not make it. My partner, the one, does. It's called Fruit Delight, which is one can of drained fruit cocktail, a half a box of white cake mix, one stick of butter. And what does this seem to be begging for you?
Oh my God.
I know. Yeah, honestly, it's very good, believe it or not.
It's begging for the clear. I'm going to say Moscato d'Asti. I would pair, you know, something, you know, stone fruit, sweet. Because dessert, you pair sweet with sweet. But if all goes well, the dessert renders the wine drier.
Right.
If we do our job right. I'm just imagining what this tastes like. I hope never to have actually tasted, but is that okay that I said that?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And see, what I think is great about this, Anthony, all joking aside, is that if you take these and we look at them non-junk food-wise. I mean, you can have things that are wonderful gorgiere, which is cheesy. You can have beautiful fish that has been sautéed or has been roasted. You can also get a fruit delight can be a beautiful fruit cobbler. So the great thing is these can translate to foods that we all do want to cook and eat, but I think it's very fun that you've found ways in which you can pair basically everything. You have not been stumped. I will find something to stump you at some point, and when I do, we'll call you back on.
Bring it. Bring
it's
it.
Been a pleasure to have you. Thanks, Anthony.
Thank you, David. Thrilled to be here.
Anthony Giglio is the resident wine guru at Details Magazine, and David Leet is the publisher of the award-winning website Leet's Culinaria, lccooks.com. You never call my name. We're talking to you this hour. Okay, let's get to your questions. Connect with us at 800-537-5252. And remember, you can always get in touch on Facebook and Twitter. We've got Kelly on the line from Buffalo. Hey, Kelly, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn.
Hello.
So, I have a quick question.
Sure.
So recently, an aunt gave my husband and I a gift of a number of different foodstuffs. And one of the things included in that was a giant box of canned green beans. So I have maybe 15 cans of green beans right now. And my husband and I are both right now in graduate school, and we're on a modest budget. So I would hate to waste all that food, but I'm really at a loss for what to do with this surplus of green beans I find myself with. And I hope maybe you could come up with some solutions.
You said 15 cans?
Yeah, probably about that. Yep.
Okay, all right. Oh, you know what's really fabulous to do with canned green beans? Because they're really well cooked. But what I like to do is to cook them further.
You know, mm-hmm. Okay, here's a great deal you can do. You can thin slice potatoes and some garlic, okay?
Okay.
And you layer them with the green beans. So start with putting some butter or olive oil at the bottom of a shallow baking dish.
Okay.
Put in a layer of potatoes so you can no longer see the bottom. Okay. Drain and rinse the green beans. And then thin slices of garlic on that.
Okay.
And some cheese. And you're going to do a layer of the potato, rather the green beans, so you can't see the potatoes. And you're going to put some browned onions on that.
Okay.
And more garlic.
Sure. I love
and you're
going
to keep doing that until you end with potatoes. And then – and loosely pack it. Don't really just press them down. Because then what you're going to do – this is going to be a variation on green bean casserole.
Okay.
Do you know how to make what's called a bechamel or a cream sauce?
I do, yeah.
Okay. You're going to make one. You're going to stir some cheddar cheese into it, okay? And okay. if you want, you could actually put some sautéed mushrooms in it. So you've got the mushroom soup thing.
Okay.
Pour that over the top. Put the little more cheese on top of that. And if you want, you can actually do some fried bits of onion or just leave it plain. All right.
Okay.
Cover it with foil and bake it for about a half hour until it's hot and bubbling.
Wow.
And that's the kind of thing you can be heating up through a week, every
Absolutely.
Other day. And you do a salad with that and you've got supper.
That sounds great.
And then the other thing is try pickling them. Just put them
okay.
in, you know, a combination of vinegar and sugar and spices. And if you want nice chili and tuck them away in the fridge, and you've got pickled green beans to go on sandwiches or just eat right out of the jar.
Okay, that sounds wonderful.
You're going to need another box of green beans.
Oh, wow, I'm so impressed. Thank you.
You are welcome, and enjoy.
Thanks. Have a good day.
You too, Kelly. Bye. We'll be back in a minute with more of your calls. And what does it mean when you dream of chocolate cake or a soup? I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're talking with you this hour. Connect with us at 800-537-5252. You can also get in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can send us an email, splendidtable.org. And Jennifer has called from Oakland, California. Jennifer, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn.
Hi.
I am going away for Christmas to visit my parents and my sister and her children. And then I'm coming back on Christmas Day because my husband has to work Christmas Day. So I'm not arriving back until about 3 o'clock Christmas Day, but I still wanted to be able to make him some kind of Christmas dinner for him and his elderly mother. But I'll be gone for the 4 or 5 days before that. So I was wondering what I could prep before that maybe would freeze okay,
right.
that I could defrost and have ready in a couple of hours. And
well, that's
I was
great.
Thinking about duck, because I thought duck would cook faster than a turkey.
Oh,
like
you
obviously
know?
I can do a turkey.
Yeah, but you know what might be interesting to do is duck breast.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, now this gets a little pricey, but there's just three of you. And
right.
duck breast cooks like a steak. It's something you would do the last minute. So you want to have everything else done ahead. Now, one of the things you can have done ahead is some kind of fabulous potato dish. You're going to be gone how long?
5 days.
5 days. Okay. We don't want it sitting in the refrigerator for 5 days. Let me just revise that. All right. Here's the deal. What you're going to do is when you get home, do you have a gadget called a mandolin? It's a thing you can thinly slice things on?
Yes, I do.
All right. This is what you're going to do. You're going to have already bought red skin potatoes. And you're going to scrub those and you're going to thin slice them on the mandolin, which is very fast. And you're going to do the same thing with an onion. So if there's three of you, I would do two nice sized potatoes and a whole onion. All right.
Okay.
And you're going to layer that. You're going to set your oven somewhere around 350 to 375. Do that the first thing when you walk in the door. And you're going to thin slice those in and put them in layers with the potatoes on the top. And you're going to put some cheese in between those layers, and I put fresh nutmeg. And then you're going to pour some cream in there. Now, it's a shallow dish, so it's going to cook, you know, fairly quickly. And you're going to put that in that 375 oven covered with foil and just let it bake while you do everything else. It'll probably take about an hour. If you want to add to that, if you want to mix in parsnips, carrots, as long as they are very thin sliced, you can alternate it and be a beautiful side dish to go with the duck.
Great.
All right. So that's in the oven now. Now, the other thing that you want to do is take your duck breasts and you're going to sprinkle them with black pepper and you're going to sprinkle olive oil and red wine over them. Put them in the fridge. And then what you're going to do is make a fabulous green salad. You will have already bought a variety of greens, like some frisée, some Belgian endive, and then something like bib lettuce. So you have tart and snappy, and you have the sweet and lovely, delicious, meaty bib. You'll rinse that, spin it dry, and then you'll take dried cranberries and pine nuts and a little balsamic vinegar and olive oil, and you'll set that aside because you'll just toss that at the last minute. And then if you want to, you could have made some kind of soup with a broth or something creamy. That can wait for 4 or 5 days in the fridge. That would be your first course, okay? Maybe a cream of broccoli with curry in it. It would be delicious.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah, really good. And you can puree that and have it ready to go, re-puree it maybe to mix it up, and finish it off with maybe toasted pumpkin seeds, spicy pumpkin seeds on top of it. But it's really easy. It's just the heat up and it goes out. And so there is your menu, this beautiful gratin of potatoes and onions, maybe carrots, maybe even parsnips in there, with the cream, which will be a nutmeg. It'll be so luxurious. You'll brown the duck breast on either side in a very hot pan, and then you will tuck that pan into the 300-degree oven. You'll have knocked the oven down, or you'll finish it over very, very low heat. Okay?
Okay.
And thin slice it on an angle and fan it on a plate. Put out the salad, put out the gratin, and you're done. And if you want to start the gratin, get it started first. You can always pull it out and reheat it if you need to. Does that work for you?
Yeah, it's great. Can I do the slicing of the things for the gratin like 5 days before?
I wouldn't do it. They're going to start getting really yucky. Yeah,
okay.
I think. But if you've got the mandolin, you can really go zip through those two potatoes, maybe one parsnip, and a nice-sized onion, and you'll zip through that, and then you'll layer it. And don't fuss over the layering. Just layer them.
Okay.
And a lot of butter or olive oil in the dish so it doesn't stick.
And then is it possible to do a pie?
A pie? Now, a pie you can really do ahead and freeze. It's just going to take a lot of time to bake. Yeah, you can. Well, you can do it ahead. You can do a pie ahead with two crusts, and you can tuck it in the freezer.
Oh, okay.
For that, I would check two websites, Dory Greenspan, because her recipes are infallible, and Rose Levy Barenbaum. These are two master bakers, and they can tell you how to do a pie and stick it in the freezer. Now, you have to defrost it in the oven, but it could go in the oven at the same temperature probably as your gratin. And you could cook your gratin slower if you need to. You've got 3 hours.
Yes, thank you so much.
You are welcome, and hopefully it's going to be just fabulous, okay?
Okay, thanks a lot.
You are welcome. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
What a lovely thing. A Christmas supper. She's going to skid in from her trip and go to work. That's great. Tim's on the line from Anderson, Missouri. Tim, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi there. Well, I've been raising geese this year.
Ooh.
I've never cooked one. And I can cook a little bit, but I really want to knock the socks off my family this year.
Oh, boy. Raising geese. Oh, my. Are they hard to raise? I understand they can be quite. I mean, the geese I've met personally, some of them have not been the friendliest of creatures.
Well, yeah, they chased my brother-in-law around the yard.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it's actually funny because they kind of try to take a bite out of him, but he's just waiting to take a bite out of one of them.
Well, now he can get his wish. Okay, this is the deal. There's a lot of fat on a goose. But believe it or not, the meat can dry out. So what you want to do is cook it low and slow. And then if the skin has not crisped, then you can flip up the oven to get that skin really crispy and crunchy.
But I had a question.
Sure.
We have an electric inside oven, but I also have a big hood on my outside grill. Would it be better to do it that way?
Well,
better heat that way, I'm thinking.
You think the heat's more even on the grill than in the oven?
Yeah.
Then I think that's the best way to go. But you're going to have to keep it pretty low. So
yeah,
you want it at about 300, 325. And this is the thing you want to do, because there's usually a fair amount of fat in the breast. And a little bit of that's not a bad thing. And there's also a fair amount of fat in the back. When you get the goose cleaned and whatever, remove the fat pockets from the tush, as we say, of the goose.
Right.
And there's usually some pockets of it in the neck. Now, don't throw that out. That's pure gold for cooking. I mean, just fabulous. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Anything you sauté in goose fat is going to be wonderful. Potatoes will make you just plots from happiness. But the thing you want to do then is you want to make just little pricks with a point of a knife into the skin, in the breast, in the back. Don't go all the way down into the meat. You just want to prick so that there's a way of some of that fat draining off.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Like a
And then what you can do is rub it with a bit of salt and pepper, okay, and whatever seasoning you like. I love garlic. And,
oh, we do too.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
we go crazy for garlic.
Yeah, and I think that, and you could have some lemon, and you could have whatever herb you like. You know, it's some of the things that are lovely with goose are things like rosemary and oranges, you know, this kind of wonderfully aromatic kind of feeling.
I have a question.
Sure.
Since we live in the country, we have lots of our own walnuts. Is there a way to, I'd like to...
Sure. Now, walnuts can have a slightly bitter edge to them. But one of the things you could do is to stuff the goose with garlic and walnuts and apples to flavor it. Now, that might get...
Now we're talking.
Yeah, now that might get very, very fatty. But my point is, when you season that goose, put it in the fridge overnight, so that seasonings can permeate it a little bit. And then put it in a shallow roasting pan. You want it to be about 2 to 3 inches high. Okay. And you're going to put some water or broth or even wine in the bottom of the pan. I always favor wine. Apple cider could work, a combination of white wine.
No, we've got some beautiful cooking wine from California. We do long-haul delivery, me and my wife.
Oh, you do? Oh.
We've got some great stuff from Sonoma, and it's been just sitting there, and I don't know what to do with it. So that's what we're doing.
But the point, this is the thing. What you want to do is put it on a rack so the fat drips away. Okay?
Okay.
Put it on a rack and start out with it breast down. And
breast down,
right.
Okay.
And then what you do is you put a little liquid, like about a half inch to an inch of liquid in the bottom. No more.
Okay.
And to make an interesting pan sauce, you can throw in some celery and carrot and chopped up onion if you want, and a bit of garlic. But the idea there is you want the fat to be dripping down into that pan. And you're going to roast it. Start it at 400 for about 30 minutes. Flip it down to about 325. And figure about 15 minutes to the pound. Baste it periodically, and about halfway through cooking, pull it out of the oven. Use heavy mitts or heavy, you know, folded up kitchen towels, and flip it over so it's breast up. And then
I have those. My mother gave me a. This is all new stuff to me cooking, and but my mother gave me a set of those big prongs that she used to get.
Yes, that's good. That's very good. And you know it's done when you stick an instant reading thermometer, which is pure gold in the kitchen, into the thickest part of the thigh, because that's usually where the meat is the thickest, and you get a reading of about 165. Now, the big trick after that is let it rest on a platter for about 20 minutes. Skim off all the fat that you can and save the fat from the pan juices, and then you can throw a little bit more wine into that, boil it until it's thick and delicious. And if you want to thicken it with a mixture of a little flour and water, a tablespoon of flour with about 4 or 5 tablespoons of cold water. You beat it in a glass so there's no lumps. And you pour that in and you boil until things thicken.
Wow. Well, you know, the geese are actually pretty easy to raise. Very good question. They're fun, but they're at the same time. They love my sister, but they run from me. I think they know the deal.
Yeah, they're very smart animals, from what I've been told.
Well, they protect the other. We have chickens, ducks, and geese, and they protect pretty much everything.
Really?
My poor brother-in-law.
Well, yeah, from your brother-in-law, too. It's very interesting. Hey, Tim, you have a fabulous goose.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy.
I can't wait. Thank you very much.
You are welcome. Bye.
Bye.
Oh, I love it. I guess, you know, attack geese, watch geese as opposed to watch dogs. Not a bad idea. 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Oh, and you can actually send us an email. You can go to splendidtable.org. Have you heard that if you dream about a sandwich, it means that you're under extreme pressure? But if the sandwich has fish in it, well, then you're just conflicted about religion. Dream analysis can get very silly, but I can't help being curious. So we're turning to psychologist Veronica Tonet. She studies dreams, and she's written a number of books on the subject. Veronica, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
So how should we look at our food dreams?
Well, I think that dreams in general are a wonderful thing to be paying attention to every night. And our dreams about food, just like every other dream, are speaking to us in a metaphorical language. So they speak in that language that we thought in before we learned how to speak, which is a language of images and feelings.
So this is sort of getting down to our instincts?
Yeah, in a way. What dreams tell us the most about is how we genuinely feel. So it's always a good idea to pay attention to any feelings you have around food in your dreams, and then to ask yourself, are those feelings that I need to pay attention to in my waking life?
So are there certain classic foods, though, that have classic meanings, like, for instance, an apple or bread or something on that order?
Well, sure. Bread, there are a lot of actually foods that are associated with religious symbols and things like that. But in general, individual dream images are always very, very personal. So a person who's had an experience with an apple where maybe they reached for an apple and fell off a ladder is going to have a very different dream about apples than a person who just loved to eat apple pie.
So how would you get down to what those meanings are? Can we do that ourselves, or do we need to go to you
or
someone actually, like you?
No, I really believe that people can do a lot of work on their dreams on their own. And one way to do that is if you have an image in a dream, an apple, for instance, and you're not sure what it's all about, you can imagine it really, really vividly in your mind and then watch and see what it changes into, and it will always change into something. So what you're doing when you're doing that is that you're seeing what your own associations are to that apple, your own personal associations, and what its meaning is to you personally.
Very interesting. Are there triggers that you found that can actually have us dreaming about certain foods?
You know, whether or not you are hungry or thirsty when you go to bed has actually been shown in experiments going way back to the late 50s to determine whether or not you have food in your dreams or you're thirsty in your dreams. So in other words, if you go to bed and you're hungry or you're thirsty, you're more likely to actually dream about food or drinking when you're asleep. And the more vividly you have an experience of eating or drinking while you're asleep, the less hungry you are actually in the morning.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So people have actually been found to eat and drink less when they've had a really vivid, gratifying dream of eating or drinking something that they just are really enjoying at night.
Oh, gosh. Now, wait. We have to figure out how can we psych ourselves so that we have... You realize you could be on to one of the great diet secrets of the century.
Right. Well, the more vividly you imagine food in when you're awake, the same thing is actually true. If you can vividly imagine yourself eating something, you actually want to eat less of it. That's been shown as well. So our unconscious doesn't know the difference between reality and fantasy. So the more vividly you can imagine something, it will often believe that you've actually done it.
Unfortunately, my hips do know the difference. But if
right.
I can convince my subconscious, I'm probably in good shape. What is your take on dream dictionaries? I've come across several of them online.
There are so many dream dictionaries out there. And dream dictionaries are just somebody who sat down and said, hey, you know, what would it mean if I dreamed about a table? Well, maybe that means I want a table something. So they're sometimes pretty creative, and they're basically just being made up by somebody out of thin air. So you don't want to put much credence in dream dictionaries. Because, again, our own symbology of our own unconscious, it's so rich and it's so personal.
Sounds like it would be much more fun than a dream dictionary.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you for talking with us, Veronica.
Sure, happy to. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Veronica Tonet is the author of The Creative Dreamer. Well, that's all we have time for today. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from the inimitable Fred Allen. He said he dreamed he was eating shredded wheat and woke up to find the mattress half gone. The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media.
Our program is supported by the Unretirement Podcast, hosted by author and journalist Chris Farrell, and features stories of people finding purpose in their paycheck in the second half of their careers. Find Unretirement in your favorite podcast app or at unretirement.fm. Now head to splendidtable.org to find information on anything you heard here this week. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Alexandra Baumhart. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.